Who's in charge here? The church, society, and obedience. What is at least common between those two titles is the individual, society, and the church. Sorry, we're going to go for that, huh? And it was also encouraging as I watched you coming in that there are several of you who've had some personal experience, like I have, of 1968. Yeah. So, just in case that you may, like me, enjoy a little bit of down memory lane, what happened in 68, I just want to go through a list of things because it's really quite extraordinary what was happening in that year. Maybe they've done this in the other talks, I don't know. But January 23rd, North Korea sees the U.S. Navy intelligence ship in the Sea of Japan, if you remember that event. We just have this ongoing relationship with North Korea, no? January 30th was the Vietnam Tet Offensive, the turning point in the Vietnam War, and all of that had to do with, huh? January 5th began the Prague Spring, you know, the attempt of the Czechoslovakians to get out under the sway, under the control of the Soviet Union. March 16th, the My Lai massacre in Vietnam of 500 Vietnamese civilians by U.S. Army soldiers. April the 4th, the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. in Memphis, Tennessee. Not to mention all of the unrest, the disturbances that went on throughout the country afterwards in demonstrations and great damage to many of the cities, larger cities in the United States. April 23rd began the student protests at Columbia University that exemplified a wave of student activism. Come back to that in a second. In May 1968, 2 months of violent civil unrest began in France, started by student protests against capitalism, consumerism, and the favorite American imperialism. The government was almost overthrown. June 5th, you say, this is almost like week by week, huh? June 5th, the assassination of Robert Kennedy in Los Angeles. Today I work in a building right next door to the site of the Ambassador Hotel where there's now a large school, public school, with the memorial to Robert Kennedy. And of course this year was a very important one in remembering him. August the 5th, the National Democratic Convention in Chicago, which was marred by protests and violence, for those who remember quite well. September the 7th, women's liberation groups targeted the Miss America Beauty Contest. Women's liberation, finding its place within our society. October the 2nd, Mexican police and military reacted violently to a student protest there. Hundreds were killed. Shortly after, October the 16th, U.S. Olympic athletes Tommy Smith and John Carlos gave the back power salute as a protest during the medal ceremony at the Summer Olympic Games in Mexico City. You remember these events, I'm sure, many of you. November the 5th, Richard Nixon, the self-proclaimed champion of the silent majority, won the presidential election. The year finished on a positive note. Apollo the 8th sent back on December 24th a picture of the Earth taken from the moon. Quite a year. So what revolutions were actually undertaken? Well, obviously those of civil rights, of individuals for life, liberty, self-determination, political rights, of a nation's right to choose their own government, women's rights, equal pay for equal work, access to education, jobs, and so many more issues related. The sexual revolution, the sexual revolution, freedom from restraint of sexual mores. A lot was happening in 1968. A little reflection can on that year that I have taken from a lecture that was given on the topic of the Year of the Barricades as one of the titles that was given to 1968. In 1968, this author quotes, a quote from this author, the entire post-war order, and this is post-war World War II, the entire post-war order was challenged by a series of insurrections from Berkeley to London, from New York to Prague. Oddly enough, the challenge was not successful. 1968 was a year of great revolution. That's the year that John Lennon sang Revolution, and Grace Slick and the Jefferson Airplane sang, now it's time for you and me to have a revolution. In a period of unprecedented material prosperity and cultural activity, the sons and daughters of the most privileged sections of the United States and of Europe, decided to make their own revolution. They were the sons and daughters of the what became known as the old left. Their parents, and many of them at least, were either pink or red. That is, many of them were communists, socialists, Trotskyites, feminists, pacifists, or just plain liberals. Their sons and daughters began to refer to themselves as the new left. 1968 was, among other things, a moral revolt, a revolt of passion in the interests of humanity. This revolt was generated by what they perceived to be their alienation from dominant social values, from the values of the power elites, the establishment, and alienation here is the key word. To be alienated is to be alone, to be isolated against your will. To be alienated in the sense of being outside, of being trapped outside. It was the feeling that you were under the control of an alien other you simply could not identify. The old left did not understand alienation. They recognized only exploitation, the exploitation of the working classes by the wealthy. This alienation, I suggest to you, is precisely what we're talking about in losing the sense of belonging. And that sense of belonging is directly related to the identity of the individual. Once they were alienated, once they no longer felt that they belonged to society, they were in search of a new identity. Some of my students know on occasion I use Carl Jung, great psychologist, you know. He has this principle that psychological insecurity increases in proportion to social security. Psychological insecurity increases in proportion to social security. So you say, as things get better, comfortable for us physically, we don't have to fight, hunting and gathering and making a life and keeping shelter over our head. Once all of those things are taken care of and we have a bit of comfort and ease, psychological insecurity begins to increase. When we have all these other things to work on, we don't have time for psychological insecurity. There ain't time for that nonsense. And in a way, we can see that our parents, when I say our, I'm talking most of those that have gray hair here, Our parents worked hard to provide for us what they felt they did not have in their growing up. They grew up in the Depression. So Social Security was low for them. And I suggest to you, likewise, a psychological insecurity was also very low because they've had all their time and energy working on keeping a roof over the head, clothes on your back, and trying to find comforts that they could only dream of as children. However, this next generation that comes on the scene and that is the source of this unrest, these revolutions that we see so prominently in 1968, come from those who had benefited from families who were comfortable or provided a comfortable life. And Social Security, having been satisfied, the psychological insecurity increases. Now he continues the quote, he says, psychological insecurity increases in proportion to Social Security, unconsciously at first, and then in relation to marriage, he says, causing neuroses, and then consciously bringing with it separations, discord, divorces, and other disorders. All you have to do is look at our society today, and you see that that principle applied in our society is verified in spades. This is very important because up to now we're talking basically about society, and we're seeing how society, affected by its individuals, begins to react when the individuals within the society do no longer feel like they belong. They feel alienated from that society, and they are now in search of a new identity because they don't identify with the values and the identity of the society in which they grew up. The issue then, if we go from society to the church, the question of the church, what was happening in 1968 when all of this stuff was going on, right? Now we have to remember that as a church, we had just come out of the Second Vatican Council. It was a good time, you could say, in the church, because the effort to clarify the church's commitment to its people and to developing that relationship with God was number one. And it is a time of applying the principles and the teachings of that Second Vatican Council. Now, in very practical ways, obviously, beginning a liturgy that was in the vernacular was one element, not necessarily the most important, but a rather significant one. In 1967, Saint Pope Paul VI, now we can say that right, just a week ago, Saint Paul VI, called his first synod of bishops. He is the one who created the institution, and he had his first synod of bishops, and that synod of bishops was to have as its hallmark, its goal, the preservation and strengthening of the Catholic faith, its integrity, its force, its development, its doctrinal and historical coherence. That was the purpose for calling them together in that. One of the things that they did at that meeting was to address the revision of the Code of Canon Law. That's my territory. Why is that important for the Second Vatican Council and implementation? Because, many people forget, in 1958, when Pope St. John the 23rd called the Second Vatican Council, he at the same time said that it was his intention to reform, to revise the Code of Canon Law, and that the council would do the preparation for this crowning work of the council, the revision of the Code of Canon Law. So as canon lawyers, of course, we take this very seriously, and happily, you know, that we are the crowning effort of the Second Vatican Council. So in 1967, they come out with 10 principles that they agree to as guiding principles for the revision of the Code of Canon Law. 10 principles. I would love to go through all 10 with you. It would be just like a 3-week program, but tonight I want to talk about 2 of them, which I think are extremely important for us. This is a little boring for people who are not into canon law, I understand, but gird your ears, be strong, stout-hearted. So the third principle, this is counting 1, 2, the third principle, because I don't want to do all 10, is certain means for fostering the pastoral ministry in the code. So he starts, the sacred and organically structured nature of the church as a community manifests that the juridic character and all the institutions of the church exist for the purpose of promoting supernatural life. I'm sure that you are delighted about that, and that makes your whole coming here worthwhile, knowing that. And it should. This says everything about the church is making sure we get supernatural life. Even our laws. Hence, the juridic ordering of the church with the laws and precepts, rights and duties which flow for it must be in accord with the supernatural end and purpose of the church. All our laws are meant to help people get to heaven. Plain and simple. For law in the mystery of the church takes on the nature of a sacrament or sign of the supernatural life of the Christian faithful. And of course, we like to hear that the law is a sacrament. Thank you. It's the least we can do for you. It signifies that life and it promotes it. Now, you would not know that from a lot of priests that you listen to, and even bishops. Of course, not all the juridical norms are aimed directly toward a supernatural end or directly promoting pastoral care. Yet it is necessary that the church's law be in harmony with the attainment of the supernatural end by all men. This is very elevated conversation about law. Woo! Hence, the laws of the Code of Canon Law must shine forth with the spirit of charity. And I want you to hear these words. The law of the church, the Code of Canon Law, should shine forth with the spirit of charity, temperance, humaneness, moderation, which is, as so many supernatural virtues distinguish the church, the laws of the church, from every human or profane law. Now, already I know that you feel a lot better about church law than you do about the law of the state of Ohio or the United States or whatever. Temperance, charity, moderation, keep these in mind. In establishing the law, the code must foster justice as well as wise equity, which is the fruit of kindness and charity. Our laws are kind and charitable, okay? In order to foster these virtues, the code must seek to arouse the discretion and knowledge so necessary for pastors and judges. The norms of canon law should not, now this is important, I'll just underscore it by drawing your attention to it. The laws, the norms of canon law should not impose duties and obligations when instructions, exhortations, persuasions, and other pastoral means are evidently sufficient for fostering a spirit of unity among the faithful. Do you hear what's being said? You don't force people to do something if you can coax them into doing it. You like that, huh? Who doesn't? Nor should the code easily establish laws that would render juridic acts null and void or that would impose ecclesiastical punishment on members of the church unless the reason for such punishment or censure be a matter of grave importance and the punishment be necessary for public good and church discipline. 1967, this is being written. 1967, do you hear what is being said? This is going to be sent out to all the bishops in the church throughout the world. What is it saying? Play nice, guys. No? Isn't that what it's saying? Don't take this law stuff too seriously. Are you with me? A reasonable amount of discretionary power and authority should be left in the hands of pastors and those having the care of souls to determine the duties of the faithful and to strike a happy balance between the duties of each individual and the conditions and circumstances surrounding his or her life. And you say, when I look at all the things, you know, Father, you tell me that before I can have my child baptized, I have to go to class, I have to do this, and I have to do this. And when my kids are going to get confirmation, they have to do so many hours of service, and they have to go to all these classes, and they have, you see what they're talking about? They say, come on, guys, you know? A reasonable amount of discretionary power. I know you're surprised, even though you're not showing it. Furthermore, the good of the universal church evidently demands that the norms of any future code, I want you to pay attention to this, that the norms of any future code, that would be the 1983 code, which they didn't know was going to be in 67, that was still on the board, should not be too rigid. I know you love that. In fact, a somewhat greater freedom should be given to ordinaries, that would be diocesan bishops, especially in certain circumstances as in mission places, can contribute much toward imbuing the code of canon law with a truly pastoral spirit and character. Now, I want you to know, over and over again, like bishops like to beat canon lawyers. Well, that's not pastoral. The code of canon law is not pastoral. It's too rigid. Come up with a different solution. But I want you to know, the principles for the revision of the code, for preparing this code, were precisely to make it not too rigid, to make it pastoral, to come back now after the work has been done and say that's not pastoral. You need to go back and figure things over again. That was the third principle. The pastoral principle gets applied and talked about by theologians. It's talked about by canon lawyers. It's talked about by moral theologians. Across the world, we hear this all the time. Number nine, the ninth principle for the revision of the code. In the revision of the penal law of the church, there is general agreement that the number of penal laws in the code should be reduced. But no canonist seems willing to admit that all church penalties be suppressed. We're not stupid. Since the church cannot do away with coercive power, which is proper to every complete society, every sovereign entity. That's the ninth principle. Reduce crimes and punishments. Are you with me? This is a lot of stuff. I agree. So, what happens in 1968? That was 1967, October 1967, the end of beginning of November. This is sent out to the bishops. It's kind of like the new marching orders, you know, of what you ought to be applying. Because the revision is already underway, but the new code is not out. You have the old one. That isn't pastoral. That has too many, you know, rigid laws and everything. So they send out the marching orders. And what happens in 1968? The big event for the church in 1968. Do you remember? You guys are intelligent and smart. Humanae Vitae, July 25th, 1968, Humanae Vitae hits the press. And theologians, priests, laity go berserk. Ah, the sky is falling. And at that point, among others, but I want to focus attention on Cardinal O'Boyle, the Archbishop, Cardinal Archbishop of Washington, D.C. A bunch of priests in his diocese kind of centered around one Father Charles Curran, you never heard of him, I'm sure, because decided that they were going to protest and that they come out with their own statement, you know, rejecting this teaching. And the Cardinal Archbishop puts them under a suspension, a penalty, okay? But I want you to know, apparently he didn't get the 10 principles for the revision of the code. Because what did they tell him? Play nice. Don't penalize. Urge, persuade, gently coax, tantalize, bring people in. Now, I want you to hear what another author, rather important one. This is from a book review by Father John McCloskey, talking about a book that is written by Weigel, George Weigel. You all know George, of course. So Father McCloskey says about his courage to be Catholic in his book, because he talks about what happened in 1968. Weigel argues that the more immediate causes of this particular crisis in the U.S. grew out of a three-step betrayal. The first, he calls the so-called Truce of 1968, when, following the issuance of Humanae Vitae, the Cardinal Archbishop of Washington, Patrick O'Boyle, placed ecclesiastical penalties on several dozen priests of his archdiocese for non-adherence to the teachings of the Church on contraception, and was not backed up by authorities in Rome, and was ordered several years later to rescind the sanctions placed on the priests. Now, I want you to hear. According to Weigel, Paul VI wanted the Washington case settled without a public retraction from the dissidents because the Pope feared that insisting on such a retraction would lead to schism, a formal split in the Church of Washington and perhaps beyond. Maybe that was what Paul had in mind. This is the nice thing when you get people, you know, who are involved in these churches, think that we have different ideas on the subject. I think that it was effectively Rome saying, hey, didn't you get the instructions? We are trying to implement the Second Vatican Council, and these instructions that are guiding the revision of the Code of Canon Law are meant to be implemented in the church throughout. And the shocking thing here is, and he calls it a betrayal. I don't think it's a betrayal. I think that it's very important that we recognize this is an authentic application of the Second Vatican Council. That's not easy to go down, and it is coming not from a theory. I am proposing it to you precisely as a document that had been prepared for the Synod of Bishops, approved by them, and confirmed by Saint Pope Paul VI. The book review continues. Thereafter, theologians, priests, and nuns who publicly dissented from Humani Vitae, who said that church teachings about the morally appropriate way to regulate birth were false. They were encouraged by the truce to continue and even amplify their dissent. This rebellion led in turn to a notorious book being published by the Catholic Theological Society of America in 1977 on human sexuality, which flatly challenged Catholic teaching on virtually every issue of sexual morality, including contraception, masturbation, and homosexuality. Naturally, this public statement, apparently condoned by authorities, eventually led to future priests being taught that faithful dissent was an option. That, I suggest to you, is not in keeping with those 10 principles. Many of those seminarians, when eventually ordained, simply did not preach authentic Catholic teaching on these matters, either ignoring them or giving spurious advice and spiritual direction in the confessional. Now, that's a whole lot of material for you. You know, I'm trying to understand what happens in 68, where all these things are going on, and what is happening in the church is reflecting it like a mirror that we just don't want to see. And it is important for us to see that this ferment that was going on has roots in, good roots, fruitful roots in our own faith. Because I go back again, that alienation separates us from belonging, losing an identity with the society, in this case, that is the church. Now, because Father Henry said so, the church, society, and obedience, I have to come back to obedience. Because it is, in the end, what pulls all of this together in that sense of ID, in sense of the identity of the individual, the identity of the society, is pulled together by belonging to that society through obedience. If we want to belong, we have to obey. There's no other way. If we want to belong to the society that is guaranteeing our share in divine life, then we have to obey the principles, the truths that define the identity of that society. And that requires an adherence on the level of the individual. And I think, I hope that you will see, your presence this evening is a confirmation of that reality. There is not one person here that doesn't have moments of saying, I don't want to do this or that I'm being told to do, either by the church, by God, or whoever. But at a certain moment, there comes in our life where we have to make a choice about who we want to be and what we want to belong to and what we want people to see us as being a part of, because it expresses who we are. I'm as equally convinced that most of us, and it's an interesting thing, and going back, and I make all these little notes to myself. I was coming out here, I had this all done, and I got here, and my file disappeared. You know, it was electronic. Well, you know how those things go. We find in that 1968 time, well, we find in the 60s, going into the 70s, that this alienation that is going on, if we see it from the perspective of faith, of the relationship with God, in one sense we can say we see the objective demands of a distant God in the face of personal weakness and failure by creatures seemingly incapable of satisfying personally those objective expectations. It was not easy for me to write, you know. You say that when we have the standard that is laid out for us, whether it's the Ten Commandments or whatever, you say these are objective norms. You look and you say, this is what is expected of you. And then you look at the way you behave. That's the personal, subjective side. And I look at that and I say, do you realize what kind of weakness there is going on in here? How am I ever possibly going to live like that? How am I going to obey? How am I going to form a bond between this weak, fragile creature and that demand from God? And we find the church right in the middle of all of that, cheering us on. See, it can be done when we do it together. That somehow the grace of Jesus himself can overcome our weakness. But if we think, I don't need you guys, I can do this by myself, I will quickly come to the realization it ain't happening. And some people decide because it ain't happening, it ain't me, babe. No, 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 it ain't me, babe. I'm off on a different path. Well, take a look at where the path leads. We have plenty of opportunities to take a look at that. But here we have before us a church that is pleading, eager to be with us and cheer us on to things that we would never achieve by ourselves. And in a way, it's sort of like these heroes that we see on the evening news, you know, Inspiration for America or something. You know, they have those things for each of the different networks, you know. People who have lost a limb or gone through cancer treatments or whatever you say. And over and again, they'll say, you know, it's the people that are around me that give me the courage to go on. Who has to do the work? The hero. But they can't do it without people who cheer them on. That is a very demonstrable experience of grace. And God is giving us that kind of grace to change our lives and actually be able to live in keeping with that norm, that objective expectation, through his grace, inspiring us to things we could never do on our own. And so, in a society which, I have to tell you, the two things that that Father didn't mention to you, that I just like to throw out. I lived 22 years in Rome and taught at our university, our pontifical university. There are some of the other fathers here who also lived there, worked there, taught there, studied there. So it's all the more encouraging. And I had the great opportunity to work at the Holy See. First, in the Council for Legislative Texts, for a lawyer, a church lawyer, can't get better than that, I think. And then I was the head of the personnel office, which put me in touch with everybody, everybody. And that experience is transforming. It gave me the opportunity to be on the inside of a number of discussions of things that we are dealing with today in the church. And that puts me in touch with the larger part of the work that I do in Los Angeles and that I have done throughout the United States, and that is dealing with clergy discipline. That's a euphemism. And because of this work, which I've been doing since 1985, you're exposed to a lot of human weakness. And the tendency that we have now in our society is to expect the church now to, I don't know, have the princes come along and kiss the toad and turn him into a prince. You know, you say that we're going to make the church something entirely different. You know? I want to assure you, the church that we belong to is nothing less than the body of Christ, the bride of Christ. We have every reason to be proud of the church. Disappointed, don't get me wrong, there are a lot of disappointments. There's a lot of weakness and failure in the church as well. But our bishops, since 2002, have done an extraordinary job of getting things back on track. I don't think you have any reason to be embarrassed by them, in spite of how the media are trying to set things up for a whole different outcome. I am honored to be here with you. I am so proud of my brothers who serve you. They love you. And I know you love us. And it is a great joy for me to be with you this evening. Thank you.